Okay. There are a couple of things I want to do starting out today. And the first one is to confess that I have never spelled a particular word correctly until today. And that word is Klebsch-Gordan. That's an A. It's Klebsch-Gordan, which I didn't know. I completely mess it up. So badly have I spelled this all this time that it's wrong in my book 4 times, including the index. So this is an A. This is an A. Let's make it look even better like an A. Since the purpose of education is to keep the next generation from repeating the errors of the previous one, don't ever misspell it now. Just get it right. Okay. So, all right. The next thing I want to do is I want to pick up a little bit of something that I skipped last time, which is important, but also very easy. And that is I want to talk a little bit about how you would get entanglement. Where does entanglement come from? How would you come up with an entangled state of a couple of particles? If you prepare 2 quantum systems independently from each other, you make a preparation for this guy and a preparation for that guy, then you'll typically come up with a product state of the two. So how do you get them into an entangled state? Well, I want to introduce to you the concept of 2 systems being dynamically independent. Or isolated from each other. Dynamically independent or isolated from each other. And that's what happens if the Hamiltonian of the joint system is just the sum of Hamiltonians from one system and the other. The sum of 2 Hamiltonians for the individual systems. And of course, we know what this means. This is I'm treating this as an operator on the tensor product space. This is really the Hamiltonian operator on A, tensor product the identity on B. And this is the identity on A, tensor product the Hamiltonian operator on B. And it's just this simple sum, which is true. And when this is the case, of course, the energy eigenstates of the composite system are just products of energy eigenstates of the individual system. So if HA of system A, let's say, is E sub A of system A, and HB of B is equal to E sub B of B, then this together implies that the joint Hamiltonian acting on the product state AB will also give you an eigenvalue times that product state. And the eigenvalue is just the sum of the energies. So, 2 systems being dynamically independent is the condition you need in order to have the energies of the system be simply additive. And so, we often consider systems to be at least approximately dynamically independent. For instance, that's a common assumption in thermodynamics. The energy of the total system is just the sum of an energy for this system and an energy for that system. So what about time evolution? What about time evolution? Well, for simplicity, we're going to assume that the H's are constant. Okay? You can do all this without assuming that they're constant, but we're going to assume that we have uniform dynamics. And then let's look at the time evolution operator for the joint system, the time evolution operator for AB. And that's going to be e to the minus I HAB T over H bar. That's good. And of course, that's just equal to E to the minus I sum of 2 pieces of the Hamiltonian T over H bar. And so this is the exponential of the sum of 2 operators. In general, that's not the sum or the product of the exponentials, but in this case, it is. Because since these operators are about different systems, then those operators commute with each other. And so this simply becomes e to the minus I hA t over h bar e to the minus I hB t over h bar. And it's the product of a time evolution operator for A and a time evolution operator for B. And that product really means, of course, as single system operators, rather, not one dimensional, what does that mean? As single system operators, of course, this is really just the tensor product of those two guys. And so that means that if I start out with a product state, psi of 0, phi of 0, that will evolve to a product state of UA of psi of 0, tensor product UB, phi of 0, which is just also a product state, which I can call psi of t, phi of t. In other words, if my systems are dynamically independent, then a product state will always evolve into a product state. If the systems have no interaction with each other, then if I prepare them independently, they evolve independently. And the global state is never an entangled state. So, two lessons from this. A product state evolves to a product state if the things are dynamically independent, if they're isolated from each other. Or, put another way, if I want a product state to evolve to an entangled state, the systems will have to interact in some way. The Hamiltonian will have to include terms that are not like this. The Hamiltonian will have to include terms that are not simply a sum of Hamiltonian for one system plus Hamiltonian of the other. Interaction will be generically the thing that leads to entanglement. Either the systems must interact with each other directly, or they must each interact with a third system, which could mediate some kind of creation of entanglement. Okay, any questions about this? A small point, but I think it's useful to see it. And also, it's a nice workout with the ideas of tensor product operators. Very simple. Okay. Great. let's see. There it is. Good. Eraser. So now I want to move into the meat of today, which is just all amusing, and probably you've all heard it 100 times, but it's so amusing that I can't resist being one of those people to tell you about it. We talked last time, among other things, about the singlet state of two spins, and this is the singlet. The S equal to 0 state of two spins, and I'm going to call it psi sub minus. And that's just equal to 1 over the square root of 2 times up, down, minus, down, up. And there are all kinds of interesting things about this. And one of the interesting things about this is that since it has total spin 0, it's rotationally invariant. So I've written it this way in terms of spin up, spin down for some particular choice of z-axis, but this state would look the same if I picked some other axis and wrote it in terms of spin up, spin down along that axis. It would look just the same. So the singlet state is a really interesting kind of state. And last time we talked about we set h bar equal to 1. I like that. Let's keep that. But this time. This time, we're going to set 1 half equal to 1. Sort of. In other words, instead of talking about the angular momentum operators directly, I want to talk about the Pauli operators. So recall that for a spin 1 half particle, the spin in the x direction, for example, was 1 half h bar times the Pauli operator x. And the same for y and z. Well, what is that Pauli operator x? Let me write down the Pauli operators. I'm going to write them down over here so I can keep them and come back to them whenever I need them. And I'm going to write them. I wrote them out in matrix representations before. Now I'm going to write them as sums of outer products. It's the same thing. The same coefficients will appear. Sx, for example, is just the outer product of up and down plus the outer product of down and up, which is pretty cool. That's the Pauli operator. And that's not Sx, that's x. Sx is 1 half h bar times that. But, you know, we're going to forget about the 1 half h bar. This is really the guts of the x component of spin, is the Pauli operator. And y is sort of like that, except it's got a couple of i's in it. It's minus I times up down plus I times down up. And z is up, up, minus down, down. Okay, and these guys all have eigenvalues, plus or minus 1. So we can think of them as being spin component observables in units where we're measuring the spin in terms of 1 half h bar. Do they have anything mysterious here? They go too far down. And so, for example, if I have a, suppose I say in units of 1 half h bar, so units of 1 half h bar, suppose we measure spin along some axis that I'll designate n hat, some unit vector n hat, so S sub n. Well, what is that in terms of these Pauli operators? Well, you can actually write that as n hat dotted into a vector which you could call sigma. This is very formal notation. Sigma is a vector whose components are x, y, and z. So now, from the Pauli operator, this is just the component in any direction in units of 1 half h bar. So from the Pauli operators, I can make components of, I can build a spin observable for any direction. So for example, if n hat is the z hat direction along the z axis, then when I take this dot product, this is to remind me of the expression rather than, I shouldn't take this vector too seriously. If I write this as a dot product, then it will be 0, 0, 1 dotted into x, y, z, which just gives me z. The Pauli Z operator corresponds to measurement of spin in the Z direction. And you can see that the eigenstates of that are up with eigenvalue plus 1 and down with eigenvalue minus 1. Okay? Everybody happy with Pauli operators? Okay, good. That's the only real machinery we need today. And the other thing I want to note is that for a singlet, the total spin is 0. The total spin is 0, which means that if I measure any component of the spin of a singlet state, I should get 0. So for a singlet, Sn acting on the singlet psi sub minus should be 0. Well, what does that mean? This is the total spin, of course. This will be Sn for spin 1 plus Sn for spin 2, acting on the singlet state. Well, it doesn't mean that I'll get 0 for the individual spin measurements. It means that if I get plus 1 for one spin measurement, I'll have to get minus 1 for the other one. And so the measurements of the measurement results from parallel spin components must disagree. If I make parallel measurements for the spin components of the spin in a spin total spin zero state, parallel measurements, those results must be negatives of each other. Those results must disagree. So, parallel measurements imply opposite results. The same thing won't be true if the measurements are along axes that are different. That won't necessarily be true. But for parallel measurements, this is true for any parallel measurements. That's a nice property of the spin of the singlet state of two spins. And so this is why we're going to think about the singlet state a lot today. So what's good about the singlet state? Well, the first thing I want to say, let's see, things about psi minus. It is entangled. Pretty obviously, entangled. We can see that that the conditional state for spin up is spin down. The conditional state for spin down is spin up. And so this is not a product state. This is not a product state. It's entangled. What else is interesting? It is entangled. Another thing is that it has nice properties. Like the one I just showed, nice properties, which will simplify some calculations. Has nice properties. Another nice thing about the singlet state is it arises naturally. Suppose you have a total angular momentum zero state that decays into two spin 1/2 systems. Then they have to be in a singlet state. If you look at the electrons in the S shell of an atom, they have to be in a singlet state. When we say they have opposite spins, what we really mean is they're in a singlet state, and so on. So this arises very naturally, and one of the things I want you to really remember about the singlet state is that it's nothing special. Even though we're going to talk a lot about the singlet state, pretty much everything we say, in some sense, is going to be true of any entangled state. We're going to use the singlet state as a tool for probing properties of entanglement, but the only reason is because it has nice properties. With a little more work, we could use any entangled state to do our work today. Don't forget, it's not the specialness of the singlet state that we're probing; it's the properties of entanglement. Yeah. Yes. For example, if you come to my colloquium tomorrow, I'll mention something called Hardy's theorem, named after Lucien Hardy, right here at PI. Hardy's theorem is a property of entangled states that is actually only true if you're between unentangled and maximally entangled, and the singlet state is in some sense maximally entangled. A cool thing that's only true in there. So it turns out that if you only focus on the singlet state, you'd never find Hardy's theorem. So that's a great example. So anything else? But, you know, more on that, come tomorrow. We're not going to talk about Hardy today. Great. Well, given the singlet, let's now do something that theoretical physics courses never do. And that is talk about culture. in particular, physics culture. In particular, to give not quite a cartoon version, but something a little bit better than a cartoon version of the history of ideas. Of course, quantum mechanics, as we know it, came into being in the 1920s, and lots of really the smartest people contributed to it. But it was very, very hard to understand. And so what they finally came to, kind of the first working way of understanding quantum theory, came to be called the Copenhagen interpretation, because it was most strongly promulgated at the Institute for Theoretical Physics at Copenhagen, run by Niels Bohr, kind of the father of the Copenhagen interpretation. And the Copenhagen interpretation was it's the interpretation that most people kind of first learn, and later on maybe they pledge allegiance to some other way of looking at quantum theory. But Copenhagen interpretation is a good everyday sort of interpretation, good everyday sort of way of understanding what quantum mechanics means. And in the Copenhagen interpretation, the idea is that non-commuting observables represent incompatible measurements, incompatible in some fundamental logical sense. So the idea is that for instance, no spin can have both a definite x value and a definite z value. No spin can have both a definite x value and a definite z value. X and z are non-commuting observables. If I were in an eigenstate of z, I would only be able to make probabilistic predictions about a measurement of x, and vice versa. So in the Copenhagen interpretation, what this really reflects, and what this really means fundamentally, is something about measurement procedures. That there's no measurement procedure which can be both a measurement of x and a measurement of z. That these things are incompatible experimental procedures, and therefore it doesn't even make sense to talk about the value of both x and z at the same time. It's not simply that if we know z, the value of x is unknown. It's that if we know z, there isn't a value for x. There isn't a value for x. So that was sort of the way the way people came to talk about quantum theory. Einstein, who had helped to bring quantum theory about, thought this sounded fishy. In particular, Einstein didn't like the notion of indeterminism, didn't like the notion of probabilities as fundamental objects in the theory. It's kind of ironic. Einstein was one of the people who had pioneered probabilistic methods in physics. Okay? All in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, he'd been inventing large tracts of classical and quantum statistical mechanics based on applying the notions of probability. But his view of probabilities were that they were simply reflections of our lack of knowledge or lack of understanding. And he thought that a fundamental theory of physics should include not just statistical predictions, but an account of what might be happening in individual events. In individual events. So for the last few years of the 1920s, Einstein tried to pick apart quantum theory. He tried to find something wrong with it. He thought that quantum theory might not be consistent. And he tried to come up with examples where you would, in effect, be able to maybe measure both x and z at the same time, or something like this. And he came up with more and more elaborate thought experiments, and they were all shown mostly by Niels Bohr to be not quite right, to be not satisfied. So about 1930, after the Solvay meeting of 1930, Einstein pretty much decided that quantum mechanics was consistent. Quantum mechanics was consistent. There was nothing inherently self-contradictory about the quantum ideas. But his fallback position was that quantum theory was incomplete. Quantum theory was incomplete. And so in 1935, Podolsky and Rosen, Boris Podolsky and Nathan Rosen, Einstein published a paper in which they argued very forcefully that quantum mechanics was not a complete description of nature, that you could look at quantum mechanics and tell that it didn't describe everything. And so so this is the famous EPR paper. EPR also means electron paramagnetic resonance, but that's not EPR in this class. That's the other EPR. This is the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen EPR. This was 1935, a tremendously influential paper. They say, well, to argue that quantum mechanics is incomplete, you have to argue that there are things that are real which are not included in the quantum mechanical description of nature. So that's raises the question, what is real? And EPR are bold. They lay out what they mean by real, something being real. They lay out the criterion of reality. Their criterion of reality. I won't write it on the board. You can look it up. I'll read it to you. Okay, here's their argument. They say, if, without in any way disturbing the system, we can predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity, the value of any physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to that physical quantity. So if you can, without touching a system in any way, predict the value of some observable with certainty, then that observable, we must say, really has that value. Okay? Because without intervening in that system in any way, I can come to a perfect knowledge of that value. It must already exist as a real thing. That must be true. Okay. So this is their criterion of reality. And so they imagine an experiment. And their experiment involves position and momentum measurements. we're going to recast it the way that David Bohm did later in the 1950s in terms of the singlet state. So what you imagine is you imagine that you create two spins that are in a singlet state, and you send spin number two over here, and it'll perhaps encounter measurement devices, and you send spin number one over here. Okay. Now recall, for the singlet state, parallel spin measurements always give opposite results. So they say, look, that means that if you measure x on spin number one, if I measured x on this guy on spin number one, that means I could predict the result of a measurement of x on spin number two with certainty, with probability equal to one. And if I measured z on spin number one, that means that I could predict this because I know this would have to have exactly the opposite result. Whatever this one was, that would have to be opposite. If this was plus one, that was minus one. If this was minus one, that one's plus one. Similarly, if I measure z here, since parallel measurements must always give opposite results, that allows me to predict the result of a z measurement on spin two with probability one. Okay, and so here's their conclusion. They say, look, without intervening in system two in any way, I can come to be able to predict the value of X with certainty. Without intervening in the system 2 in any way, I can come to predict the value of Z with certainty. Therefore, both X and Z values must be real for spin number 2. Both X and Z values must be real. But quantum mechanics doesn't describe any situations in which both X and Z values are real. That is to say, if one value is definite, the other value must be indeterminate. Therefore, the quantum mechanical description of physical reality must be incomplete. There must be things that are indisputably real that are not encompassed by the quantum mechanical description. That's the argument. And it's a powerful argument. It's a powerful argument. Is it right? Oh, okay, that's another question. But it's a powerful and very influential argument. Let's take that apart just a little bit more. What are they assuming? What are they assuming? Well, they say we're going to do this without disturbing the system in any way. So how do I intervene in the system? My intervention in the system is simply to choose which measurement I perform on spin number 1. That's my intervention. So their first assumption is an assumption about what constitutes a disturbance, what could possibly affect outcomes of measurements. So their first assumption, okay, their first assumption we might call L, which is to say, stands for locality, and that means that the choice of number 1 measurement does not affect number 2 outcomes. Okay? They're assuming this. And since these two spins could conceivably be very, very far apart, and my measurements could be at space-like separation from each other, then relativity would sort of lend credence to this kind of assumption. Their second assumption is what we might call the quantum mechanics assumption. And that means that quantum mechanics correctly describes, correctly predicts the correlations in this entangled singlet state. The word entanglement, by the way, is also of 1935 vintage due to a paper by Schrodinger. Okay, so these are their assumptions. And from this, they want to draw a conclusion. The conclusion is what we might call HV, hidden variables, and that's the assumption that there must be elements of reality, that is to say, definite values of complementary observables not described by quantum theory. They're hidden. They're underneath the quantum description. They're behind the quantum description, but they must really be there. Yeah, you're going to say. We make measurements on spin 1. From this, we predict the results of measurements on spin 2. Now, in order to check those predictions, of course, I'll have to go ahead and make a measurement of spin 2. But I could measure, or I could measure Z, and my choice of measurement doesn't, by this assumption, that choice of measurement doesn't have any, doesn't count as any sort of disturbance, doesn't affect any measurement result that might be made on spin number 2. For example, the spin number 2 measurement might already have been made in some frames of reference. That's the assumption. I'm playing it within the EPR paper. I will then critique it, but let's give them their due. Hidden variables assumption is these complementary variables have definite or determinate determinate values at the same time. That's their conclusion. And their argument is that if I take the locality assumption together with the facts of quantum mechanics, according to EPR, that implies that I must have hidden variables. There's the EPR argument in a nutshell. Okay. So, are they right? Well, of course, you can, as you might imagine, Bohr couldn't let this stand, and so he actually replied to the EPR paper with another paper in the same year with the same title, something like, Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Reality Be Considered to Be Complete, or something like this. He said, this criterion of reality that they have is actually ambiguous when applied to quantum systems. He said, look, there's no question of a mechanical disturbance, of a force or an exchange of energy from the choice of observable in system one instantaneously over to system two. There's no question of that. However, in this system, you still have to make a choice. You can choose to measure either x, and therefore predict x with certainty, or z, and therefore predict z with certainty. You can do one or the other, but you still can't do both. Those things are still complementary experimental arrangements. They're incompatible experimental arrangements as a logical matter. In quantum mechanics, you have to consider the entire system, what's happening to the entire system, including what's happening at widely separated points if the system is distributed in space. You don't have action at a distance. It's not that my intervention here has some sort of instantaneous action here, but you do have what you might call complementarity at a distance. Even though this is a distant measurement, the two conceivable experiments are still logically inconsistent. They still cannot be done both at the in the same instance of the experiment. Why not? Oh, well, because you can't make a machine to measure both x and z for spin one, for the same reason that they're inconsistent with a single spin measurement. Yeah. I mean, in the same instance of the experiment, I can do the experiment many times, sometimes measure x, sometimes measure z, but that's not what complementarity says. It says that the incompatibility of quantum observables is directly related to the fact that we cannot build macroscopic experimental apparatus to perform simultaneous exact measurements of incompatible observables. Yeah?
Well, ideally, we might try to make a machine to measure spin x, a machine to measure spin z, and then make them act at the same time.
Well, but the problem is that as soon as they're both acting, they no longer perform correctly. So if I try to make a machine that has two dials, one of them that's going to register the spin in the x direction, and one of them that's going to measure the spin in the z direction, okay? And I try to make that machine work, I can't make a machine that if I send in a state of definite spin in the x direction, the x dial gives me the right answer, and if I send in definite spin in the z direction, the z dial gives me the right answer. In those experiments where I know what the right answers are, I can't make a machine that always gives that information. So I can't really certify this machine as measuring both x and z. Yeah?
What if you measure spin along x in the particle number one, and then along z particle number two?
That's not the EPR argument. That's something else you could do, but that's not any correlations between those things, and actually wouldn't need statistical correlations between those would have nothing to do with this argument. I mean, that's another possible move. And indeed, as we'll see, it's an extremely important possible move to imagine making different measurements on the two observables. That's a key question. But from the point of view of this argument, it's irrelevant because they're just using the fact that these parallel measurements must give exactly opposite results. Okay. Yeah.
Any problem with once you measure this x spin for number one simultaneously, it's not for number two, and it's spread with infinite velocity?
Yes, they said that didn't make sense, and so there in some ways their entire argument that therefore the actual value of the x component of spin over here, for example, must already have existed, that the quantum description must not be a complete description of what's going on with the system. The value of x must already have existed over here, because it was not sensible to imagine that something you did over here had an instantaneous remote action at a distance effect on the state of this guy over here. That they thought that this was a sign that quantum mechanics was inadequate, incomplete, not good enough, supersedable by some better theory. Okay? So that's the EPR argument. Bohr's counter-argument established as a logical proposition that the EPR argument didn't quite hold water. However, it really didn't remove its intuitive force. Okay? A lot of people looked at this and said, yeah, this is pretty weird. This is very strange. They sort of went along with Einstein, many people did, and said, well, quantum mechanics must not quite be right. This business from entangled states sort of indicates that's probably not a complete description. A lot of people thought that. So then came John Bell in 1964. As we all know, we're getting to John Bell. Okay, John Bell, an Irish particle physicist who got interested in this and some other related questions in quantum theory in the early 1960s. And he turned the argument on its head. That's what he did. He turned the argument on its head. What he said is, let's imagine a world in which both locality and hidden variables were true. Let's imagine such a world. So Bell. Imagine a locality plus hidden variables world. So locality is the choice of one measurement doesn't affect the choice of outcomes on the other experiment, on the other system, and hidden variables have determinate values. He says that the assumption here is that the probabilities that we see in our experiments are simply due to our ignorance of the values of some variables that are in nature somehow, but we don't see them, and we don't have direct access to them, and because we're ignorant of their values, we assign probabilities to different experimental values. But if we knew those variables, we'd be able to predict exactly, we'd be able to know exactly what the results of all different kinds of experiments on the spin would be. Okay? So he's going to imagine a world in which you have hidden variables that function locally. And what's the function of the local assumption here? Well, Bell wants to be able to make statements like this. If you measure the value of observable A, you'll get the value plus 1. He wants to make a statement like that. But you wouldn't be able to make a statement like that unadorned if locality wasn't true, you wouldn't be able to make that statement because what you got for the variable A might depend on a choice of measurement way over here. Okay? Without the locality assumption, then I can't just say, on this system, if I measure A, I get this particular value. That statement wouldn't have enough conditions on it. I'd have to start saying, if I measure system A here, and that measurement was was variable C, and that measurement was variable X, and so on, then I'd get plus one. He wants to be able to talk in simple terms about, if I make this measurement on this system, I'll get this value. Okay? That's the role of the locality assumption. And the hidden variables assumption is just granting Einstein's wish. Okay, so, so what we're going to imagine, once again, is we have a source of a pair of systems, and here we can make two different measurements on number one. This is number one over here, and this is number two over here. We can measure A, or we can measure B on system one. And over here, we can measure C on system two, or we can measure D on system two. So there are a couple of complementary variables for each guy, and I'm going to assume that all the results are plus or minus one, and that's an assumption that would fit in very nicely if I were to make these guys a couple of spins, and these guys were components of the spin in some directions. And I measured in units of 1/2 h bar. That would fit together very nicely. Okay? Now, I'm going to actually derive not exactly what Bell did in 1964, but what a sequel that came a little bit later. And so this is really not Bell's theorem I'm talking about. It's really the Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt result. Named after John Clauser, Michael Horn, Abner Shimoni, and Richard Holt. In 1969, they came up with the four-on thing. That's the easy one to consider, easy one to understand. So we're just going to go with this version of it. All such theorems are generically called Bell theorems. Okay, now I can't measure both A and B in a particular run of this experiment. But I could measure both A and C. And I could imagine measuring them both and taking their product. And if each one's plus or minus one, that product's going to be plus or minus one. So I can measure, if you will, I can measure AC, or I can measure AD, or I can measure BC, or I can measure BD. And they're all going to give me plus or minus one. And any product of these measurements will give me a plus one or a minus one as a result. And each of these is a possible joint measurement of the system. Now, suppose I think that all of these have definite values. All of these have definite values. And furthermore, because the choice of measurement doesn't affect that value, the A in AC and the A in AD are the same A. Okay? That these guys are really the same A. Because the choice of measurement on system number two doesn't affect the value of my measurement result in system number one. So in the local hidden variable world, the world governed by local hidden variables, all of these have determinate values. So let me write down a quantity that's composed of these guys. M is A times C plus D plus B times C minus D, which is AC plus AD plus BC minus BD. Okay? Let's suppose I could write down this quantity. And what could that quantity be? Well, you can sort of see. If the value of C and D agree with each other, then this term is zero, because C is equal to D. And therefore, I get plus or minus 2 because I have A times C plus D. I get plus or minus 2 here. If C and D are opposite, if 1's plus 1 and 1's minus 1, then this term is 0, and therefore I get plus or minus 2. So whatever values I assign to A, B, C, and D, the value of M can either be plus 2 or minus 2. In any run of the experiment, the secret value of M, and M's, I can't ever measure M directly, but the secret value of M is got to be plus 2 or minus 2. That means that if I do many, many, many experiments, and I measure the value of M, and I take the average value of, I didn't measure that, I imagine the value of M, and I take the average, if M can either be plus or minus 2, and I take the average of M, what can I say about the average? No, you can't say it's 0, because plus 2 might be more likely than minus 2. Well, what you can say, though, is it has to be somewhere between plus 2 and minus 2. You know that the absolute value of the average of M has to be less than or equal to 2. Which means that the absolute value of AC minus the plus the absolute value of AD plus the absolute value of BC minus the absolute, the absolute values over all of them. I'm speaking wrong, although I'm writing correctly. Okay, this absolute value of this combination of these guys, that must be less than or equal to 2. And this is the Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, Holt inequality. It's a particular species of what's called a Bell inequality. And it's an inequality that holds, that must hold for observables like this in any world governed by local hidden variables. Whether or not we know the local hidden variable theory, we know that if the world is governed by hidden variables that function locally, then this is true. And this measurement, or this thing, is experimentally testable because I can measure these expectations statistically. I can estimate these expectations with different groups of experiments. I can take a quarter of the experiments and dedicate it to finding this average. I can take another quarter, dedicate it to finding this average, and so on. And because the choices of measurement on one system don't affect the results of the experiment on the other system, those will all be fair. Those will all be fair samples. Yeah. Oh, because this variable, which is equal to this combination of variables, can only have values plus 2 or minus 2. And if I take a million numbers that are all either plus 2 or minus 2, and I take their average, that average has to be no bigger than plus 2 and no smaller than minus 2. The absolute value of that average has to be less than or equal to 2. No, the results can be quite different. The results can be different, but each variable can only have the result plus one or minus one, independent.
AC being plus one, AD being plus one, BC being plus one, and then that would be minus one.
Ah, well, because if AC is plus one, and AD is plus one, then C and D must both be the same, right? C and D must both be the same. But if C and D are both the same, these two things must be the same. And therefore, they'll cancel out. Okay? Right, so just look up here. Just look up here. The question is whether C and D are the same or not. If C and D are the same, then this is 0, and that has to be plus or minus 2. If C and D are different, that has to be 0, and this has plus or minus 2. Okay. All right, very good. This is the right place to ask the questions. All right, so this is a potentially experimentally testable inequality that must hold in any universe governed by local hidden variable theories. Okay, what about the quantum universe? Well, now we're going to do exactly as was suggested. We're going to imagine taking the singlet state and making maybe somewhat different measurements maybe somewhat different measurements on the two spins. Okay? So we've got a singlet state. Well, first of all, let's consider a spin measurement just in general. A spin measurement. And let's consider a spin component which we'll call K. I don't know why I'm calling it K. I guess S would have been fine. K sub theta, which is at a which is at an angle theta from z from the z axis in the xz plane. And then my my rule about let's call it S sub theta. Surely that's a better S sub theta. Okay. Then my spin rule here tells me that that S theta is equal to the cosine of theta times the Pauli Z operator plus the sine of theta times the Pauli X operator. Okay? Now, let's consider the singlet state. Let's consider the singlet state. And we're going to be given psi minus, and we're going to measure z on spin number one and S sub theta on spin number two. I want to find out what the expectation of that is. Okay? Well, to do that, I'm going to work out of operator identities. So if I have z1 z2 acting on the Pauli acting on the singlet state, what do I get? What do I get? Well, what does z do? What's the action of z? The action of z is to not change whether you're up or down, but to add a minus sign if you're spin down. And so I have two terms. One of them is this guy, where z1 doesn't affect up at all, but z2 gives me a minus sign for down. So we get minus up down. And this guy, where z1 gives me a minus sign for spin down, and z2 gives me just spin up back. So I pick up an extra minus sign, which with that minus sign gives me this. And so this tells me this is just minus psi minus. Okay. Okay, that's cool. How about z1 x2? What does that give me when I apply it to 1 over the square root of 2 of up, down, minus, down, up? Okay, what does that give me? What does that give me? Well, what does x do? X changes up to down and down to up. That's what x does. Okay? So, if I apply this to this, let's see, x2 will change that down to up, and z1 won't do anything because that's spin up, so the first term is just up, up. z1, x2 acting on this guy, let's see, z1 gives me a minus sign because this is spin down. x2 changes this up to down, and so I get plus down, down. Well, that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool. The point is that this guy is orthogonal. This guy is orthogonal. We'll give this guy a name. We'll call him phi plus. This guy's orthogonal to that guy, right? And so psi minus phi plus equals 0. Okay, great. Now, we're ready to do our calculation. And let's do it over here. Okay. So, the expectation of z1 s sub theta of 2 will be the expectation of z1 z2 times the cosine of theta plus the expectation of z1 x2 times the sine of theta. I just wrote s theta in terms of the cosine and sine. But our state is psi minus. So this guy is psi minus inner product with z1, z2 times psi minus is just minus psi minus times the cosine of theta, so minus this thing, plus psi minus inner product with z1 x2 times the singlet state gives me phi plus times the sine of theta. This is 0. This gives me 1. And so the inner product of these two things is minus the cosine of the angle theta. Okay? So far, so good? Are we happy and satisfied? Now, of course, what's special about the z-axis? Absolutely nothing is special about the z-axis. This is a rotationally invariant state. Psi minus is rotationally invariant. Psi minus is rotationally invariant. That means that I've worked out what the expectation value of the product is for these two guys, which differ by theta. But because the state's rotationally invariant, this must also be true for any two spin components that have an angle theta between them. Okay? So psi minus is rotationally invariant. And that means that if I have two spin components, V and W, that have an angle theta between them, that implies that the expectation of V1, W2, is equal to minus the cosine of theta. That's true for any spin observables. This is why the singlet state is so lovely, of course, because we can just solve all these problems at once, and we know this expectation of this product. Okay. Questions about this? We've now worked out what the expectation of the product of two spin components is for the singlet state. I'm going to erase this part, I'm afraid, because I want to save what I have over there. So in our quantum situation, we have a singlet. It's producing two spins, spin number one, and the singlet. We're producing two spins in a singlet state, that is. I've drawn a box here which is supposed to produce the two spins. It's labeled with a singlet state. That's labeling the preparation of the two spins. And here, I can measure A1 or B2. And here, I'm going to measure C2 or D2. And of course, B has to be B1. A1 and B1 are both possible measurements of spin 1. C2 and D2 are both possible measurements of spin 2. And all I have to do is tell you what directions to make these measurements in. And then I'll be able to use this to calculate all of the expectations that appear in the Clauser-Horn-Shimoni-Holt inequality. Isn't that great? So let me draw you a picture. All these guys can be chosen in a plane, and I'll have A1 and B1 at right angles to each other. And with orange chalk to help you understand, I'm going to choose C2 and D2 to be at right angles to each other, but tilted at pi over 4. So all these angles are pi over 4. All these angles are pi over 4. What's the cosine of pi over 4? 1 over the square root of 2, right. So that means that the expectation of AC here is 1 over the square root of 2, which is the same as the expectation of BC, because they're also at an angle of pi over 4 away from each other, which is the same as the expectation value of AD. All of those guys are minus sign right here, the cosine of pi over 4, which is 1 over the square root of 2. How about the other guy, the expectation value of BD? They are at an angle of 3 pi over 4 apart, right? How, what's the cosine of 3 pi over 4? That's pi over 2 plus pi over 4, which is, exactly. The cosine is minus 1 over the square root of 2. And so when I take the negative of that, I get plus 1 over the square root of 2. Therefore, for this choice of spin measurements, for two particles in a singlet state, total spin 0 state, I get that AC plus AD plus BC, these expectations, minus BD is equal to the sum of these guys, except this one appears with a minus sign, which is minus 2 times the square root of 2. This is one of those places where, you know, we should ring church bells and trumpets should play a fanfare and so on. Right. So this means that quantum mechanics can violate the Clauser-Horn-Shimoni-Holt inequality. Because, of course, the absolute value of this is 2 times the square root of 2, which is like 2.8 something, and that's bigger than 2. What does this mean? What Bell is saying is that if you have locality and hidden variables, that implies that quantum mechanics is not true. Okay? That quantum mechanics makes predictions that will be found to be false. Now, you can do this experiment. It's been done many times with increasing precision and detector efficiency and wide separation between these guys. You know, they're more and more space-like separated and so on. I saw an experiment about 10 years ago at the University of Innsbruck where these measurements were made on opposite sides of the university campus, about 500 meters apart. These were photons. They were traveling along optical fibers, and the experiments were made. The measurements were made so rapidly that if a signal got from the choice of experiment here to the result here, it would have to travel at 20 times the speed of light. And they found that the Clauser-Horn-Shimoni-Holt inequality was violated to 30 standard deviations. Okay? All right, quantum mechanics is right. And that means that local hidden variables are wrong. We can say that with as much confidence as we can say anything about experimental physics. local hidden variables are wrong. They can't be right because there's an inequality. In fact, there are lots of inequalities that must be true in any world governed by local hidden variables. And that inequality is experimentally violated in a quantum mechanical experiment. Not only was Einstein wrong, he was dead wrong. His hypotheses and conclusion are not compatible with each other. It's a subtle mistake, though. It was a very fruitful mistake because it got people thinking about this. And so let's not be too hard on the old guy. But EPR, the EPR argument is wrong. And this is a big deal. Pretty much, a local hidden variable theory is the common sense view of the world. The common sense view of the world is that whatever happens here is due to things that maybe you can't see that are all happening here. Okay? And that if you can't predict what's happening here, well, maybe if you just knew more, you'd be able to predict it. That's pretty much the common sense view of the world. And it's wrong. Now, is this a problem? No. In some sense, no, it's not a problem at all. Quantum mechanics makes a prediction. Quantum mechanics is right. No problem. Okay? On the other hand, without being a problem, thus narrowly defined, it's certainly interesting and significant. I would even argue that in a certain sense, it's a kind of mystery. If you think about this for a while, which may or may not be a good idea, you think, well, that's really strange. How can it actually be that way? That's a very, very, very strange thing. This fact that local hidden variable theories make statistical predictions that are violated by quantum mechanical experiments on entangled states is sort of that theorem, which has many, many forms, is often called Bell's theorem. Since he proved the first version of it. Yeah. It instantly finds out. That's actually maybe not the right language. What is the right language? That's a really good question. Having just proved a theorem that tells me that my intuition about entangled states is utterly wrong, I am loath to proceed to an intuitive statement about what's really going on. Right? I mean, if nothing else, Bell's theorem should make us insist that we very carefully define what we mean when we say things like that. The particle instantly finds out what the result was. Can we come down to an operational meaning for that? Either the meaning just is that they're correlated in this particular way, or that's a much harder thing to define. Yeah.
Instantaneous
is also right because there may be frames of reference in which this happens first, right? If these happen in a space-like separation, there will be. Okay. Now this is a big deal, and it's the tip of a huge iceberg. In fact, that's not even a fair comparison because icebergs are like, you know, 1/8 of them is above water. But this is only, you know, a very tiny percentage of this entire subject. We can talk about other statistical inequalities. There are lots of different ones, and many of them tell us different things. We can talk about weaker hypotheses. We have assumed that all of these variables had definite values before the measurement. But in fact, we can make weaker assumptions, weaker probabilistic assumptions, and still come up with an argument like this. We can talk about that some other time. We can look at other states. The singlet state is nice, but you can look at all kinds of states. And in fact, you can prove that by appropriate choice of variables, any entangled state, any entangled pure state of 2 qubits violates a CHSH inequality by at least some amount. Okay? We can talk about other kinds of results. This is a statistical inequality that has to do with averages. Things that, you know, these results could be one thing or another, but they average out to this. There are other results that don't have to do with statistical averages. Somebody had a question. Yeah. Okay. There are hidden variable theories that certainly for ordinary quantum mechanics work quite well, but the hidden variables are non-local. That the hidden variables are instantaneously influenced remotely. The famous theory by David Bohm, which is an example of this, explains the statistical behavior of quantum systems, but. At the cost of throwing out the locality assumption. And this is the origin of why people sometimes say that quantum mechanics is non-local. That's such a standard term, I'll surrender to it. But really, all Bell's theorem says is that you have to throw out either locality or hidden variables. And I'd rather throw out hidden variables myself. Okay, so there are non-local hidden variable theories that seem to work. Although they're kind of bizarre. In fact, Bell was originally inspired to his work by noticing that the hidden variables in Bohm's theory functioned non-locally, and so that's where this all came from. In fact, as far as other models for what's going on underneath quantum mechanics, I don't know any that I'm really happy with. Okay, but some people try to find them. Bell's theorem is a really great time saver. If you're a theoretical physicist, from time to time you'll get something in the mail or sometimes email these days from a crackpot, and the crackpot will have a theory about how the world really works. Okay, and you feel kind of obliged to maybe read it because maybe you're funded by a government grant, and you know, it's a citizen, and so you know, kind of gave you some money, so okay. So you read it, but if you get to, and you find out that their theory is a local hidden variable theory, you don't have to read any further. You know it's wrong, okay? You can exclude an entire class of theories, and lest you think that this is just an amusing instance, let me give you an example. Somebody who's not a crackpot, but is eccentric, but brilliant. And that's Stephen Wolfram. And Stephen Wolfram, in his book, A New Kind of Science, more or less tries to argue that we have to think about the world as a cellular automaton. But a cellular automaton is a world governed by local hidden variables. And so Stephen Wolfram's ideas, no matter how refined, won't be able to pass the Bell's theorem test. I've elided over some conceptual issues here, but I'll put it that way. This was Yes, von Neumann had a theorem excluding hidden variables, but his theorem was based on a mathematical assumption that there's really no reason to believe is true. Okay, it had to do with his theorem is widely regarded as being not very interesting. Yeah, but it was interesting in that he tried to show, he was the first person to try to show that quantum mechanics couldn't be due to hidden variables, and was in that sense the grandfather of an entire industry with hundreds and thousands of papers about all kinds of things. Yeah. Ah, well, it depends on what you mean by locality. Because you can show as a theorem in quantum mechanics that no intervention on this spin, no choice of measurement, no dynamics, no anything that you do to this spin can affect the statistical properties of this spin. And therefore, you cannot use entanglement as a by itself as a communication scheme. You can't use it to signal. I cannot do something to this spin that produces an observable result on that spin. Any kinds of correlations can only be detected if we then bring the information together. Okay? All right? And so, in that sense, quantum mechanics, the dynamics of quantum theory, is entirely local. Is entirely local. There's nothing here that can make a measurable difference over here. The only things that the correlations do is tell you something about consistency between the results, but that can only be examined later. So that's a sense in which quantum mechanics is quite local, statistically local. But of course, quantum mechanics only makes statistical predictions. So how should I insist? If you take apart this idea very carefully, I think you'll find that in order to really nail down that idea, you're always facing, you're always trying to say something like what the measurement result would have been if I had measured something else. And quantum mechanics is not like that. Nature does not feel obliged, as Asher Peres said, to have, unperformed experiments have no results. Nature doesn't feel obliged to have questions to answers to questions that we didn't answer we didn't ask. So that's where this goes. I think we're gonna adjourn now because it's getting toward our usual time. There's more we can say. There's lots more we can say, but we're not going to. We're gonna leave this here and move on to something else tomorrow. So, all right, see you then.